Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening from whenever and wherever you're listening. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Afropolitan Central. I'm one of your co-hosts, Omolayo. I am a Nigerian American currently living in London and getting her master's in migration and development. I'm here with your lovely co-host, Nana.
Whoop whoop, I am Nana, a Ghanaian currently living in London, working as a financial services consultant. Together, we're Afropolitan Central, a bi-weekly podcast that brings you fresh, exciting, and intellectually stimulating discussions about the African continent and diaspora. Alrighty, so let's jump into today's episode.
Welcome back to another episode of Afropolitan Central. Very special guest with us today. Paco, would you go ahead and introduce yourself?
What's up, y'all? My name is Paco Sando, and I am the 24-year-old Ghanaian American CEO of Mzizi International.
Woohoo! That's so awesome. And so today, we had to bring Paco on because we wanted to talk about starting a fashion business within the context of honoring our heritage, especially from the diaspora. What is it like to, you know, start up these businesses and ensure that we are paying tribute to our traditions while staying, you know, like front end of these businesses and like staying like current in these fast paced like trends and everything like that. So we're just really excited to kind of like just, you know,
get this conversation going.
Exactly.
And just get the insights and the thoughts rolling.
You know, by all means, it's a pleasure to even be on y'all's show. Thank you for having your boy.
No, I'm excited. Yeah. So, Paco, I know that was like a lightning fast introduction that you did for us.
Yeah.
Like, do you want to tell us a little bit more about yourself? Don't be mysterious now.
Exactly. We're one that are honored, and you need to tell them why.
How far back do y'all want me to go, though? How much do you want to know about Paco?
Hey, as much as you want to tell us and tell our listeners.
Okay, so I was born in Brooklyn, in January 19, 1995. I only lived there for like 2 years before my mom, she didn't want me to be raised out there.
Okay.
So I moved to this more bourgeois neighborhood in outside of Columbus called New Albany, New Albany. So I was pretty much raised out there. I was like the only black kid in a lot of my classes. And like growing up, I really had rejected my heritage. I just wanted to fit in with the white kids, you know?
Okay.
And like, yeah, so I barely speak tree. I didn't eat as much watching KK as I could.
Boy, we have just disowned you. Your Ghana flag, your Ghana card has just been revoked.
But I'm learning.
That's the important part. Yeah.
Okay.
As whenever I grew up, so my mom, she lost her job and we relocated to Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
We stayed with another Ghanaian family for a little bit. Mm-hmm. That didn't work out. And then we moved to a neighborhood outside of Dallas called Plano.
Mm.
Let me turn that off. So, like, whenever we moved out here was whenever I started getting, like, my first real taste of diversity.
Mm-hmm.
I started actually accepting my skin color and accepting my culture.
Mm.
And then after, like, being raised out here, I went to high school and such, graduated. I ended up going to the University of South Florida for school. And that's whenever I got, like, my first real culture shock. And that had me questioning, like, okay, who is Paco really? Like, what are the different parts of my identity that really just make up me? Because, I mean, I had never listened to dance hall like that. I had never been, I just never been as exposed to, like, West Indian and Caribbean culture. So, like, being out there, I was really lonely. I couldn't really relate to anybody.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I came across this guy who was straight from Nairobi, He was like straight up from Kenya.
Yeah.
He used to wear like literally all the stuff that we wear over here, whether it was shirts, joggers, socks, but would have Kenyan fabric stitched into it.
Mm.
And I just thought that was dope as hell.
Mm.
And like, so he was pretty much in the same situation I was in, coming to a completely new place, not having any support, no family, no friends. So we really just kind of hit it off. And one thing that I'm learning about people who are from the continent is that a lot of us are very lucrative. So even just talking to him, he really just kind of opened my mind up. He really showed me that money doesn't discriminate. Literally anybody can get it. So just after talking to him, like, we sat down and brainstormed. We went through like a list of words that are African related. We got down to roots. He translated it in Swahili. And then we heard Mzizi, and I was like, okay, bet. Like, that's the one.
That's the one. Aww.
And, like, essentially, I wanted Mzizi to be something that literally anybody could wear and still feel representative and feel proud of who they were, like, regardless of their location. No, I don't want people to feel as lonely as I did being in Florida and not having any friends and no one to connect with.
Yeah.
So, like, after that semester, I really, like, that freshman year was tough for me, so I straight up didn't want to go back to school. So that summer, I went to New York, tried to find a manufacturer for Mzizi.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted everything to be like pretty or run pretty remotely, so I wanted to find a manufacturer that do everything from start to finish,
mm-hmm.
whether it was like design creation all the way up to distribution and logistics.
Mm-hmm.
I found someone. I went out. I met with them, inquired with them, and they literally told me that it would cost them $500 to make a baseball jersey.
Whoa.
And that they would have to hire extra staff to do everything that I was trying to do with Mzizi.
Wow.
So I got really discouraged after that. I kind of scoured up and down the garment district, tried to find another manufacturer, tried to find like a fabric sourcer, I just didn't have any luck. And I literally remember it was on my way to Harlem. I just kind of asked myself, I was like, okay, what if they're right? Like, what if you are trying to do too much at once?
Mm-hmm.
Out of everything that you are trying to do, what is the one product that you know that will sell the best, if anything?
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, that's whenever, like, baseball jerseys were a current trend.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Whenever, like, retailers from Forever 21 all the way to Champs had their own, like, version of baseball jersey. So I was like, I can run with the African baseball jersey. Let me see where this takes me. So after that, like, I went back home. Moved back to Dallas. I took a semester off of school just because I didn't know if Tampa was where I wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And like during that time, I worked as a server during the week at Buffalo Wild Wings, and then I worked as a pharmacy technician at CVS during the weekends.
Oh, and my little brother used to do that.
Man, it's not easy.
Yeah,
it's not easy. Like literally working in those two different job environments, I was able to see like the difference in how each affected me.
Yeah.
Working in as a server in a sports bar, it was more upbeat. I could work a double shift and then go party after.
Mm.
Working at CVS was a lot more draining.
Mm-hmm.
It had like slow periods and then really fast paced, high intensity, stressful periods.
Mm-hmm.
And you're dealing with old crabby people all day who just want their medicine. They don't care what you have to say or how the system is.
Yeah.
And literally, I was going to school to become a pharmacist. Like, mm-hmm. I was getting my BS in biomedical sciences.
Mm-hmm.
So working at the pharmacy and seeing that the pharmacist was literally doing everything that I was doing, but they were just signing off on the final signature or counseling the patient, I was like, yo, this can't be what I'm about to go back to school for.
Mm-hmm.
So that's whenever I started taking Mzizi a little bit more seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I found a manufacturer in California. And all of this is through Google searches. Like, literally...
Wow.
All of it, anything can be found with just a little bit of intent, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I found a manufacturer in California. I started putting more money. They were a bit more expensive, but I started pumping more money into, like, further developing the designs.
Mm-hmm.
I figured out which countries had the biggest populations within the United States.
Okay.
Deduced it down to Ghana, Nigeria, Ethiopia, Egypt, Kenya, Eritrea. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to make a plain Africa... like jersey just to be inclusive for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so started pumping more money into that, decided to go back to school or go back to Tampa my sophomore spring semester.
Okay.
Was homeless, was couch surfing. Wow. Stayed with my ex, stayed with my homies. It was like 9 of us in a 4-bedroom apartment.
Wow.
It was literally filth. Like, we had a dog, a cat, 2 sugar gliders. And
what did you have all those pets for?
What is a sugar glider?
We couldn't even feed ourselves. It's like a flying squirrel.
Like, you had a rat like, in your house?
We had 2 of them. Flying ones, you know, with wings.
Oh my goodness.
It was hell. Like, I used to wake up mad because all the odors that would just hit me all at once.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So literally after that sophomore semester, I literally bounced to Orlando and stayed with a friend that I grew up with who ended up going to University of Central Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And just being out there was really what helped me keep just my peace of mind, helped mm-hmm. me keep like my spirits afloat, just being mm-hmm. with somebody that was I was comfortable with, that I could trust, and that like I was familiar with, you know, like it was a friend. And So literally over the course of like that sophomore summer, we're just partying, we're doing odd jobs to scrape up some money.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we're just doing what we need to get by. And by the end of summer, it was literally through divine connection. Because all throughout those 3 months, I had been finding out, okay, who are my competitors? Who are all the brands that aligned with Mazizi's, like, the African streetwear branding? And then, okay, if that's the case, if I can't get the product manufactured myself, how can I go about selling the designs to these companies so I can make money off licensing and royalties?
Mm.
So, yeah, like, I literally compiled a 50-page business plan about, like, okay, this is the product. This is where the populations and the markets are at. This is how to target them. This is who they're following on social media.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty simple because, like, this is whenever all the African dad finds and Twitter videos are popping. Like, yeah. Sam takes off, like, the homie. Yeah, so it wasn't too hard to really just capture all the eyes of at least the West African market at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I literally sent that pitch to... I sent it to companies in... all over North America, whether in the States or Canada, mm-hmm. all over Europe, from like UK to France to Germany to Australia. Wow. And everybody told me no. Wow. Everybody told me that it was a cool idea, but they just didn't want to run in that direction or they just ignored the hell out of me.
That's
so,
how it is. Oh, yeah.
I by think, the end of summer, I was really, really discouraged, man. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so like it had turned out that the guy that I was staying with, his roommate's stepbrother owned his own clothing brand called 2K Life.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a more known clothing brand in Miami, but they're more known for their pool parties because I guess they throw like celebrity pool parties that a bunch of people come up to. Aside from that, they make custom merchandise for these celebrities as well. So I was like, yo, I know this is not your core competency, but this is a different market that I see is growing. Would you be willing to take it on? Homies, he still told me no.
Dang.
And it really... But he actually ended up pointing me in the right direction. He was like, stop trying to get it manufactured in the States. Why don't you look on this platform and see if you can get, see what they quote you there.
Mm-hmm.
So I hopped on. I got 3 different quotes. I got a sample within a week. Realized that it was a third of the price that I was getting charged over here, but it was 10 times the quality.
Mm-hmm.
I had the business plan already, so I knew how to sell everything and how to start it. So within 2 weeks, I called all the homies. I flew back to Dallas. I had a whole bunch of samples made and sent back home. I set up a photo shoot in downtown Dallas. And then by August 30th, 2015, I officially launched Mazizi. I haven't looked back since.
Woohoo! Dang. I feel like I should clap. What a story. Dang. And then also, I feel like we haven't quite told our audience, like, because they're hearing this story now and they don't realize just how much you've achieved since 2015 from a collaboration with Marvel. For Black Panther and your feature on Forbes and all these amazing things. And I think if you read the Forbes article, you do kind of like get a little bit of a picture of that, but not as much as the story that you've just told us now.
Absolutely.
And then I feel like if someone just goes to scroll through your Instagram page, they'll just be like, oh wow, like look at these people who popped up overnight. But your story shows that just how much time and effort and sweat, blood, and tears. Yeah, you put into it.
So I think that kind of like leads us to our first question, isn't it? Because this story you kind of told us has had almost like a constant theme of rejection with, you know, different manufacturers and, you know, different people almost saying, oh, you know, I think it's a cool idea, but we don't see the business merit. Why were you so convinced that this was a thing that could launch, this was a thing that could be profitable, and this was, you know, telling that the African story through fashion was such an important thing to do?
Yeah.
I am very bullish when it comes to ideas. Like, I'm really stubborn. I get it from my mama. But, like, when something makes sense to me or whenever, like, I really get my mind wrapped around the idea, I really commit to it. Once I saw the value in Mazizi, once I saw how the designs were growing, I saw the potential and I saw how even a product like it, the impact that it could have, that's when I was like, okay, let me just stick with it and see where it can go. And I was told so many different directions of, oh, you should sell shirts instead, or why don't you just try selling one product, or why don't you just try selling... I mean, I did try a lot, because although I didn't try all that, I did try to license the designs individually.
Yay.
I tried to, like, say I'll target, like, a Ghanaian company, and I tried to sell them the Ghana design.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, like, that collection was a family, and I didn't want to, I wanted to give it its due diligence. So, I mean, I'm the kind of person who I'm going to try everything possible if I know it's possible. You know, so, like, I literally will exhaust all of my options. And until literally God just finally gave me that yes.
That's amazing. And another aspect that I really liked about your story is, like, the full circle that you've come. And because you said that, you know, when you were growing up in Brooklyn and then later you were, like, super ashamed of your story, of, like, your background and, like, you know, your family originally being from Ghana and everything like that, to now just, like, the complete 180 where you're, like, highlighting, like, various African cultures, not even just Ghana, because, you know, you were saying you were, like, looking at Ethiopia and all these other cultures that are really prominent within the African diaspora in the U.S. And so, I don't know, it kind of reminds me a little bit, because one of the reasons why we're really interested in talking to you was because I know Nana and I had a similar awakening, I guess, in at Elon. I was like, where did we go?
Elon University.
At Elon, where it was just like, dang, like, how do we highlight our stories? How do we put these on a platform? So I guess I wanted to ask you, like, well, for you, what is the importance of telling our stories, and particularly through a medium like fashion, which people typically think is, like, trivial, you know?
So with fashion, one thing that I'm learning is that it's expression, but in a subtle but powerful way. You know, you're able to, like, fully represent who you are and put it on display without having to say a word. And it's that much more important in learning about yourself, owning that story, and then learning, okay, how is it that I want to tell it? How is it that I want to be represented? How do I want my identity to be put on display? Because I never even imagined myself as going to be the owner of a clothing brand. I never never dabbled in fashion. I was going to school for biomedical sciences. But at the end of the day, it's literally just a medium. It's easy transcends the clothing. It's a movement. You know, it's kind of a celebration of our identity. So I don't necessarily just limit it to the clothing.
Yeah, because I think on your website, you have, like, a Tumblr link where it kind of shows, or it does, like, little profiles of people wearing the jerseys and them kind of telling why it's important for them to, like, express themselves this way, etc. And I think that's, like, a brilliant idea because it adds, like, such a, like, a good personal touch to it because it's really, like, you know, I think it can be very easy, particularly in this age, for a company to build its brand on, oh, we're all about our roots, or oh, we're all about XYZ, but then it just kind of be a gimmick. But I think with Mzizi, like, one thing that I noticed, like, from either through your social media pages or your website, your features, etc., is that, you know, you live and breathe it. So, you know, kudos to you guys for that. But I what I was telling Omalaya too is that I feel like it's quite difficult to try to build an authentic brand and to be able to build a brand that can really connect with people, you know, past trends or, you know, past whatever, and particularly in this age of fashion too, where so technology is playing such a big role in customers dictating what they want, etc. You know, how, you know, what's the secret sauce, like, how have you guys done it and continue to maintain that authenticity even as you grow?
That's
a hard question because like this is not a thing that I ever prepared for, but before we launched, like, I did do my due diligence in researching Mzizi, researching the market, researching, okay, who is a target market that I want to, like, actually get this product in front of. Although it's a niche, like, how big is the niche? How many millennials are in the States? Where is the room to scale? And, like, I really just thought it through. If I had launched Mzizi whenever I first had the idea, it would have never been nearly as successful or sustainable as it is today. It was over the course of that year and a half and, like, further developing it, putting more money into it, taking that extra time to actually do more research, figure out, okay, where are these competitors or people that, well, I don't even have any competitors, but who is it that?
Okay.
Just what's the overall landscape? I definitely, and then the one thing that's my mantra, I say it all the time, is that acquisition of knowledge is a catalyst of progress. The more applicable knowledge that you learn, the faster you can get ahead in whatever direction that you want to go in. Because literally nothing under the sun hasn't been done. There's always been somebody in time who's written about it, whether it's on the wall, whether it's in like a hieroglyph or a scroll, or even the Bible, you know, there are answers everywhere. It's just all about being intentional with how you're searching and looking to learn.
Nice. And then speaking of learning, real quick, actually, I think, do you do the designs yourself? Because you were talking kind of about the design process and sourcing all these different things. But so who designs the jerseys themselves, actually?
Yeah.
We work with different designers. For a majority of Mzizi's history, we did work with one designer named Dom. But for the most part, now we try to expand, work with local designers, people who are of that nationality, so that whenever we are creating jerseys for these countries, we hit all of the cultural nuances. Because these people are from the culture, they know like the little Easter eggs to add to the design. So like, for instance, for the Ghana Independence jersey that we just dropped,
that was designed by...
I was happy about that one. Our little Sankofa Saka jersey was designed by Kwesi Oben. He's actually in, he's in Ghana himself, and he's like our Ghanaian creative director, as well as like graphic designer.
That's amazing.
So that I'm really excited about your answer, because it really like leads us into another thing that we really wanted to like parse out with you and just like kind of pick apart a little bit. And it's this idea of like Afrocentrism and like tokenizing like African culture. And so a lot of times, you know, when we talk about this, like when we talk about the critique of Afrocentrism is that it sometimes like flattens African culture to be like this monolith, right? So sometimes when we're like, oh, African fashion, people aren't like nuanced about like where it comes from, and it makes it seem as if African culture is just like one big thing, instead of even though we understand it as like specific, you know, various cultures that have so much diversity even within all the different cultures. So I kind of wanted you to talk a little bit more about how you guys make sure that like you're staying true to that, like, and not falling into like tokenistic ways of talking about African fashion or African culture. And so like what that looks like for you.
Definitely. So I mean, with each design, like we've had our fumbles before in the past, where we would make assumptions based on the culture just from like a Wikipedia search. But we had to realize that like that's not being authentic. That's not how we're really going to truly be representative of these people. How can we say that that's our value when we're not actually doing the due diligence and researching and putting it in that time into the design? So yeah, I mean, that was literally just about taking note of that, realizing like, okay, maybe this set of people in this area are a different size, so they prefer smaller size jerseys as opposed to larger ones. Or there's certain taboos that are there certain taboos that you need to be just mindful of whenever you're making a design for this, or how they might accept this because of how the religion is over there. So yeah, I mean, like, as it's a learning process. I literally can't fault anybody for lumping it as a monolith, because at the end of the day, like, there's so much culture to dive into. It's literally about just if they want to be intentional about them learning and like realizing there's so much within each of these regions, each of these countries that make up the continent.
And I know I asked a similar question to a friend of mine, Anika Hobbs, who owns Nubian Human out in DC, which is this like boutique that sells a lot of like not even just clothes, but also like books and accessories and all these things from African designers. And so I asked her that similar question about like, oh, are you worried about like tokenism and Afrocentrism and all these things that kind of like flatten the African culture into a monolith? And so for her, she was kind of like, well, you know, like our storefront is the invitation. So even if they come thinking they're just consuming generic African culture, they stay for like the events and the stories that we tell that make that nuances these conversations. And so I think, like you were saying with you guys' Tumblr page and the features that you guys do, I think you guys also definitely do that. So like people might come and be like, oh yeah, African jersey. But then like they stay for the story, they stay for the authenticity, and they learn from that.
Exactly. And each of the pieces, we like making them conversational. So say we add like independence here on the back, and someone comes up and asks like, what's that number? You're able to educate them and tell them about your country. Or even if you don't know, that just enforces you to go back, learn a little bit more about your country so that you don't put in that situation again
where you don't know. I think for me, I'm still very much stuck on the fact that you guys involve people from the particular countries or people on the ground to make sure that it's in touch. And I noticed that you guys have expanded the jerseys to have you know, obviously to the wider diaspora. So I think maybe you have like some for Latin American countries, for instance. Is that correct? Yeah.
We do. We have like Dominican Republic, yeah. Costa Rica, Puerto Rico.
So what is the process like of adding a new jersey? Is it like, you know, you get social media demand for it, and then, you know, you start to say, oh, maybe Dominican, let's look there. Like, or what does that look like for you guys?
It's really just a matter of like, okay, let's take a full landscape view of the year. What are the independence years that are coming up? What are people asking for on social media? How big is the diaspora within the states for that country? And at the end of the day, like, if we make the product, will we have people to sell it to? So it's all about like finding that balancing game between like, okay, we're trying to be representative of the bigger countries to make sure that the business itself is sustainable. But because we are something for the entire diaspora, we don't want to overlook the smaller countries as well. We want to find these smaller pockets and make sure we're representing them fully too. So it's literally just about just taking all of those factors into consideration, seeing what's coming next, and seeing, okay, what's the next best opportunity that we should take.
That sounds really good. I got quite excited for some reason when I saw, like, you know, the wider diaspora countries included as well, because I don't think I've quite seen that.
Yeah, like a lot of people just focus on the African continent and that diaspora, but maximum they'll like look at the Caribbean diaspora, but I don't really hear too many people going further into the Latin American diaspora. But it's just really interesting the way that you guys, you know, engage with social media and ensure that like you're listening to customer demand. And I know we were just like wondering like how you not just like stay on trend, but maybe even stay ahead of trend, right? Because you said you were thinking like a year in advance and everything. And then similar to that, like what happens when the trend of like, oh, proudly African moves on?
What happens when the trend of proudly African moves on?
Or maybe it won't. I don't know.
I mean, is that something you've ever considered even?
I never have, because as long as I know Nigerians, they're the proudest people ever met in my life.
Guilty.
That's a very good question, though, because that's not necessarily something I ever have considered. But at the end of the day, where I want Mazeezy to grow into is like a fully actualized lifestyle brand. I want us to be everything again from head to toe. Not just jerseys for these countries, but actual sportswear. It's where we're representing and sponsoring kits for organizations and making jerseys for different leagues, making jerseys for these national teams, kits and such.
This is just
a start, because at the end of the day, you get famous for one thing first. So, I mean, we're riding the trend, and I mean, we're just claiming as much territory as we can while we don't have any competition until it's time for us to actually start, we hit the mainstream and start diverging into more products.
That's really exciting. That's so because great. I think about like the Nigerian jersey, for instance, for the World Cup, and how much like crazy response like that got. And just imagine like a brand like Mazeezy, like a homegrown, like actual African brand being behind that. Like that would be like
insane. Soon come. We're working.
Soon come. I love that.
Soon come. Yeah. Talking of big things, how did the Marvel collaboration come along?
So that one was another test of persistence. So this was back in October, whenever the Black Panther movie trailer had first dropped. Everybody had hopped on Twitter talking about, yo, what should we wear to the movie? Let's wear some traditional gear. And then we had customers who were actually like, yo, why don't we wear Mazeezy? Then we had more customers who were like, yo, why doesn't Mazeezy make a custom jersey?
It's customer demand.
Feel me? So I was like, okay, like, that's a good idea, but I don't know how that is. Marvel's a huge company, and we're just like a three and a half year old black-owned business. But, I mean, I juggled the idea some more. I started doing more Google searches and started, like, figuring out, like, okay, what are the holes in Marvel's marketing? Because at the end of the day, all solving is solving someone else's problem. So I was just figuring out, like, okay, how were they marketing Black Panther? What problems were they having with diversity and inclusion? Who worked in the licensing department on LinkedIn? Who made the merchandise for Marvel?
Wow, and you are like resourceful, Lordy.
I mean, all of it's literally on the internet. It's just about being intent with it.
So
literally after that, I put it on a mind map. From there, I put together this proposal. I made a whole Wakanda mock-up design. And by December, I finally sent it to them. They told me no. And I I pushed a little bit. I was just like, well, thank you for responding, but where I was raised, no means maybe, and maybe means yes. So unfortunately, okay. I can't take your no for an answer.
Dang.
They didn't really like that. They didn't like that.
No.
So they actually like started ceasing their copyrights and infringements team on me and told me that like if we release any Marvel trademark gear, then we would be sued, pretty much. And so from there, I was like, okay, let me back off. What if we take a different direction and have the public put the pressure on them? Mm. How about we have people, like, I don't release, like, a mock-up commercial, and then have people tag Marvel and say that, like, oh, we want to release the jersey, but if you want it, you have to tell Marvel that you want it and let them let us release it for you. Mm. So that's whenever we started, like, that whole campaign. The video dropped. It got picked up by the Shade Room. And, like, literally throughout the course of this entire time, I had been, like, as I said, I found everybody who worked at Marvel on LinkedIn, and I call it kind persistence. at the end of the day, as long as you're professional and as long as you're polite, like, the worst thing someone can say is no or just ignore you. So through that entire time, like, through all of this, I had been just contacting everybody, like, keeping them updated. I'm like, yo, like, this is Ms. Easy, this is the video, this is, look, it got picked up by the Shade Room, it's going viral. A lot of people still ignored me, but there was still like one lady who was pretty responsive. She wasn't pretty responsive. She was just, she would respond every few months. So fast forward to like February now, Black Panther is about to drop. We hosted an event called Mzizi Movie Night to where we rented out a movie theater and we put it out to where if you had a Mzizi jersey, you could watch the Black Panther movie with us for free. And if you didn't, it's just $5 and we'll cover the rest of your ticket. And so we had that event. It was like a cool little family reunion in Dallas. And after that, like, I mean, by then it was like, okay, well, it's kind of over now. The hype is pretty much gone. The movie has dropped. It doesn't really make sense for us to keep pushing this jersey. And so we decided, like, okay, like as a team, we're gonna stop putting money, resources, and time into this because we need to focus on products. Like I said, I'm pretty stubborn. I can get really, really stubborn, especially when something doesn't make sense. And so literally, the one lady that was responsive for the few months, she finally hit me back like in March, just saying, okay, let me see what I can do for you. Let me get an email and I'll get back to you. And so a few days later, she sent me an email. I found who that person was. I found all his colleagues on LinkedIn, emailed all of them. Still didn't hear anything for a week. And I had told myself, I was just like, yo, like, I know we had passed this, but if I had had their emails originally, like, in beforehand, all of this, I would have still sent a follow-up email to them. So I sent the follow-up email. And literally within a few hours, I got a random email from some lady at Disney saying, yo, we love your tenacity and ambition. Can you talk on the phone in an hour? And like two days later, I was in LA talking to Disney's consumers products team, trying to figure out how to make Wakanda real.
Whoa! That is insane. It reminds us, like, I don't know if you've heard about, you know, TEDx, and here in London, there's a thing that they call TEDx Eastern, and Amala and I volunteered at it last year, and there was a story of this Rwandan neurosurgeon.
Yes.
And your story and persistence reminds me so much of her, because she was trying to go to neurosurgeon school, if that's what they call it, or neurology, I don't know, that school. And she emailed for over 2 years, just trying to get in. And that, like, that is
not even gonna get in, just to get her application seen or something,
just to get her, just to even get her application, because they were like, we think not. And so this story, like, because you could have stopped like in October, like,
especially even after the, and even after March, I feel like in March after the movie dropped, I'd have been like, okay, well, we tried.
Moving on.
Oh, that's so beautiful. And I love that, like, the email that they sent back wasn't even just like, oh, we love the design. It's like, we love your persistence and tenacity, which reminds me that, like, talent is cool and everything, but, like, hard work pays off so much more. Hard work and persistence and consistency. It
definitely does.
And I think, you know, the more we talk to you, I think I got the sense from the Forbes article anyway, because I think even the journey of launching Mzizi, I was like, oh, damn.
But like, it really is like a almost like a hallmark of the brand.
Yeah.
Just, you know, not being able, not giving up, and just being intentional and just, you know, just persistent.
Agree. And I think that's like something that I think a lot of brands need to take on, especially when we are thinking about representing various African cultures, right? So I think this is one of the ways that we move it past a trend, because when you're able to like have so much passion for it, so much like commitment to it, that shows that you know that it's more than just a trend. Like, it's your life, it's your culture, it's your story.
Absolutely.
And that's like what really sets it apart. And I hope that other brands who are trying to represent quote unquote African fashion or African culture or whatever do show that level of like commitment and passion for telling our stories, because without it, like, all we're doing is tokenism, you know?
Absolutely.
That's true. Y'all are too kind, man. Y'all make me blush. Have y'all ever seen a dark skin dude blush?
Rosy cheeks over here. Yeah, it's like so warm, just so like warm. Can't tell.
I was looking for it. Like, I saw there's this guy I follow on Instagram called West African Man, and he kind of has like, you know, different African like memes and jokes and whatnot. And I'd seen something that he posted about like, you know, entrepreneurship, like you cry a roll tears and just wipe it, and then you just have to move on.
Yeah.
That's literally, you're just like, all right, now what? You know what I'm saying? Like,
let's continue. So I guess another thing that I was really curious about, and like that kind of piqued my interest in looking at the website, was you had mentioned that you would want to eventually, you know, potentially manufacture in the African continent. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, where are you right now in kind of actualizing that dream, and what sort of, you know, insights can you share, or what have been the obstacles, or, you know, just tell us a little bit more about that.
I can't exactly say where, but we are looking to manufacture in South Africa to start. One insight that I can tell anybody who's looking to manufacture products in Africa is that there is something called the African Growth and Opportunities Act. At least for the U.S., most of the sub-Saharan African countries are able to import into the States tax or tariff-free. And one thing about the manufacturing industry is that it's like a pack of flock geese. It goes to where the market is most suitable. It goes where resources are abundant and where labor is cheap.
Yeah.
And so there's a book called The New Factory, The Next Factory of the World, How the Chinese Economy is Reshaping, or How the Chinese Dragon is Reshaping the African Economy. And it just talks about how the manufacturing industry is moving from Asia to Africa and to the continent, to different regions of it, whether it's from like Rwanda and Ethiopia to Botswana and Lesotho. But yeah, so I mean, it's a matter of just like, it's a bit harder because it's not the same, I don't know, internet access isn't necessarily the same per country, and the same, can't usually use it exactly in the same way as used over here. But nonetheless, yeah, I mean, we went out to Johannesburg to Ben for Afropunk. We were able to meet with different manufacturers out there. And we had a workshop for the vendors out there, too. And we were able just to make a few more connections. And one thing that I'm seeing is that, like, Africa's a wave. The fact that we'd be able to even help boost local economies, get people jobs, and have that made in Africa tag, like, that just makes the product that much more authentic. And, like, that's where we want to go. I want to be able to manufacture in the homeland. I want to be able to actually say that I'm manufacturing the Ghana jersey in Ghana.
Yeah.
Soon come, though.
Step by step, soon come. Yes. I'm super excited about it. But I will feel like a bad Swazian if I don't point out that I think... We don't have to go into this too much, but I think because sometimes the issue with fast fashion is this idea that they are continually looking for where labor is cheapest, which ends up, like, you know, turning into a lot of human rights violations and all these sweatshops. So what I don't want to see, like, as we look to, because I'm definitely with you, like, I definitely want made in Africa tags, but what I don't want to see is us replicating the sweatshops that we've seen in Asia and other parts of the world where manufacturing is really big. So I want us to go and manufacture in various locales in Africa, but I want us to do it differently. I don't want us to use the same streams of exploitative, I don't want us to use like exploitative means that have been done, that have allowed fast fashion to be so cheap. because the reason fast fashion is so cheap is because of the cheap labor, and it's because like people are working in really violent conditions. So I think that we as Africans, as we're thinking to like, you know, raise the African economy and create jobs, let's make sure that they are like safe, secure, and dignified jobs. Even if it is in a manufacturing plant or whatever, it should still really be dignified. So I definitely want that to be something that all of us keep in mind.
Yeah,
that's
Yeah,
I mean, cut you off.
No, you're fine. I think I guess what I was thinking is that like, I think for us as young Africans, and you know, maybe I'm just giving people the benefit of the doubt, but I think for us when we say we want to go back home and manufacture, yes, it is about, you know, the labor costs and labor prices are probably a good constituent of that, because it'll make sense for your business model. Because you know, wages are not as, you know, it's not flat. But I think for us, that personal connection of it either being our homeland or being our continent land, that's not a thing, but I just made it up. I think that there's that initiative where we're concerned about how can we improve the community that it's in,
right?
How can we make this sustainable?
Yeah,
how can we make it actually enrich the community that it's in?
Yeah,
so I don't know, I just give, I guess I give African run and owned startups and, you know, businesses that normally want to go back home, it's normally from a place of, yes, of course, like it's business, and so the profit line and the bottom line has to make sense. However, I think a lot of times like we do have that good intention of we need to make sure this is also sustainable. And sorry, Papa, I know you're eager to say something.
No, you're good.
But there's another there's another lady I follow on Instagram, Freddie Harrell. And she has that business called Big Hair, No Care.
She's great.
She's trying to move our manufacturing, I think, to Nigeria right now. And that's a big focus of hers as well. Like, we want it to say, you know, made in Africa, but we also want to make sure that it's sustainable. And it's good. So
sustainable and just,
definitely. And that all depends on like the integrity of the business person.
That's exactly what I was to say. Like, I agree with you about the benefit of the doubt, but I think if people don't keep it front of mind, it's easy to like outsource. And because usually a lot of these companies, they're all like, oh, ethical, da da da, but like they don't know, they outsource so far out that they don't even know where their stuff is made. So, but you're right about integrity and intention.
So, funny enough, sorry, I think this will probably just take us on a tangent, but I don't know if you guys saw in the news that what I thought was a Nigerian or an African startup, Jumia, has filed its IPO, but it turns out it's like it's German owned.
Their licensing is like in Germany or something. Wait, it's in our group chat.
Yeah, the licensing is in Germany. The technology headquarters is in Portugal. I thought it was founded by Nigerian entrepreneurs, but it turns out that their business model is to get local, quote unquote, local founders that like kind of makes the brand very much like, oh, this is homegrown. Like, literally, this was the first time that I ever found out that it wasn't a homegrown company.
Yeah. So HQ and legal registration in Germany, tech center in Portugal, top management located in Dubai. But and then the customers are 100% African. But I don't know about who actually owns it. It could be Africans in the diaspora.
I'm really not sure. Because it's by a bigger company.
Okay.
It's a bigger founding company that does these investments. Because another thing that they had been talking about was the fact that a lot of his operations for the last couple of years have had a negative bottom line, like big losses. But the company has deep enough pockets to keep it going. Because obviously if your cash flow is negative, you can only stay afloat for so long.
Right.
But they've had enough to be able to play the long game. And y'all, when I tell y'all, I was shook.
Shook.
I thought this was like a company by Nigerians that was doing the damn thing, getting IPO listed. Not to realize that it was like German backed and owned.
Right.
And I thought it was particularly interesting that part of the strategy too is to get local founders. So like local figureheads, I'm like, this is just too deep. So. Yeah,
and I think it just goes back to this whole idea of this whole idea of like how Africa is trendy right now, right? And so like how people can like use it if it's a trend, just like use the name Africa if it's a trend.
I mean, that sort of just ties all back into us telling our own stories and making sure that we're the ones at the forefront. Pushing our culture forward.
Exactly. Absolutely. And I was at the SOAS African Development Forum this past weekend. I was on the team that helped put it on, and Amina J. Mohammed who is the Deputy Secretary General of the UN. She was our keynote speaker, or one of our keynote speakers. We had a few other people as well, but she basically like emphasized that too, like the importance of Africans like telling our own narratives, because she was basically saying like she's tired of seeing like research and reports coming out of the Sahel that are by like all these randos from like the EU and whatever, and she's like, there's no reason, like we are more than capable, like more than smart, more than resourceful enough to like create the research and the reports on our own continent, and like be the ones change at the forefront of changing the narrative of, well, she was talking specifically about the Sahel because she was also talking about climate change in that area. But she, I think she meant it for the whole continent as well.
So yay for Miss Izzy.
Being a part of that narrative.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, Amala, do you have any questions on your end? I think, to be honest, I think, like, this is the company that, like, I'm always, like, since kind of coming across you guys. Mm-hmm. And why are you laughing over there?
Because y'all make me smile, man. Yeah. I really appreciate the support. Thank you.
Yeah, but I think it's absolutely amazing, because I think a point that we had kind of touched on earlier in the episode was the fact that, you know, in the age of Instagram, like, it's very easy. You know, I think it's a good and bad thing. Like, a good thing in the sense that, like, entrepreneurship is so accessible because, you know, everywhere you look, you know, somebody's starting a business, somebody's selling something, somebody's doing something. So it's very easy for us to aspire to do it. But I think what also happens with that sometimes is that it can cheapen it. Maybe cheapen isn't the right word, but it can make it easier than it is. Because it takes a lot of, you know, blood and sweat and tears to be able to actually build something that's
meaningful,
you know, meaningful and whatnot. And so, like, seeing what you guys are doing with your brand, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's inspiring. And I'm excited to see what you all have next in the future. Yeah.
Yeah. So I know you said earlier that you guys do stuff like a year ahead. Can you tell us of like some of the projects that you're working on and, you know, what we can expect?
So one thing that I've, fingers crossed, that I'm trying to make shake. I like this whole African movies in the media theme that we're working with. So, I mean, I'm going to see what we can drop this July for. Okay. I'm not going to say it. Y'all can do your research.
Do your math. We'll do the math. Yeah. Google real quick. I'm so like out of it as far as like what movies are on right now. Yeah.
I have an idea, but I don't want to say if I'm like completely off the mark. So yeah. I'll go and double check.
You didn't touch on, you didn't like your heritage like at the beginning, right? And so now that like you're on the other side, like, you know, all in with Mazizi, this is what you do full time along with your whole family and everything. Like, how do you feel as a member of the diaspora, like working on this? Like, what does it make you feel about not just the project that you're, not just the business, I apologize, not just the business that you're working on, but like you as a person and like your pride in your heritage and what you have like working on for the future and stuff?
This has honestly been like the most fun and fulfilling phase of my life I've ever experienced. Going into college, like, I thought I was going to be a pharmacist. Coming out of it, I'm CEO of Mazizi, and like I would never, ever turn back.
Yeah.
It's because like just seeing the impact it's had, the emotions that it evokes out of people, even how proud it makes parents, just seeing how their kids are repping. At the end of the day, I'm just happy that God blessed me to be a vessel.
It's a question that kept niggling at me, and I think I'll just keep forgetting, but how did your mom initially react when you know obviously studying
medicine, like
biomedical, etc., then be like, oh, I want to start this?
So my mom, she's not the typical African mother. She always supports me in whatever direction I want to go in. Okay. But nonetheless, she wanted me to finish school before I started Mazizi.
Okay.
And we used to butt heads a lot because whenever I moved back home, she had saved like a small trust fund for me that I wanted to use to invest and start the brand. I said, because it was way too costly for me to just start up on what I had at that time. Ultimately, like, over the course of time, my mom, she kind of saw how consistent I was with it. Whether it was, like, having the money that she would send for food, I would put it back into the business, or me just going through that homeless period. She ultimately ended up being our angel investor, because finally, after, like, once she saw the product, she saw the business plan, she saw like the pictures, the models, she was like, okay, how much do you need? She ended up selling her stocks, and I was able to invest $4,500 in production, and she gave me another $1,500 to invest in marketing. And yeah, like my mom, she's been supportive ever since. Like now she's the warehouse manager, Ms. Easy Mama. Anytime there's an order, she goes to the garage, she picks and pulls it, she packages it, and then she wraps it up and ships it off to the post office.
Oh, so every package we receive has the touch of your mom's love.
Exactly.
Love it.
Exactly. Aww. She prays over it and everything.
Oh, look at that. You're getting blessings.
Yes. Amen. Amen. Pass them over here.
Oh, goodness.
So tell us a little bit about what else you do, like, outside of Mazizi, so that we get the whole round picture of Kakao the person.
What else I do outside of Mazizi? I don't know. I'm actually a pretty boring guy. I smoke a lot of weed. I read a lot of books. I watch a lot of, like, documentaries.
I did not expect that.
That's why the creativity comes from.
It's the truth. It's the honest, God honest truth.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, honestly, a lot of times I like spending good company.
Yeah.
So a lot of my friends, I like people that I keep around me, they're all pretty inspirational in their own right. And I just make sure that, like, I show them that they're loved, and they're always reminding me that I'm loved as well.
Good.
So, like, yeah, man, keeping those people around and keeping your spirits high and realizing that just helps me put, like, my best... It makes me realize how much trust is put into me.
Mm-hmm.
It helps me put my best foot forward every single day.
Yeah.
So.
And you really need that on this journey because it's a long one, but you've been killing it. You've been killing it, sir.
I'm trying my best. Well, thank you, though.
So as we wrap up the episode, like, you know, are there any last words that you want to tell our listeners? Either as people that want to be entrepreneurs,
mm-hmm.
people that are struggling with their heritage, mm-hmm. people that are, you know, from all the different themes that we've touched on, if there's anything you want to leave them with.
One thing that I would leave people with is that the journey is always continual, whether it's the journey of entrepreneur or whether it's the journey of finding out who you are and your identity. There's knowledge in learning about yourself. And don't be upset if you don't necessarily, if you're confused about where you are right now. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, like, life is fluid. It's going to take you in a whole bunch of different directions, and all the experiences will teach you something new. Yeah.
Ooh, a word.
That was a mouthful.
Preach. Yeah. No, that was amazing. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. This has been a really good conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Filled with a lot of insight, because I think, you know, for me, obviously, like, you know, like I keep saying, there are lots of things that I really admire about you and, you know, the business that you've built. But I think also one thing I'm really taking away as well is just, you know, the power of tenacity and persistence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it sounds generic, it sounds cliche, but I think that it makes a world of a difference.
Yes. And also believing in your story and the story that you're trying to tell.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And, like, it's literally law of averages, the more no's you get, the higher probability of a yes is going.
Let me tell that to my job application process. Something's gotta give.
Yeah. So, Paco, as we close off, you know, where can our listeners find you? You, Ms. Izzy, like, you know, whatever, everything.
So you can find Ms. Izzy on literally every social media platform at MIZIZISHOP, so at Mazizi Shop.
Mm.
A website, MazizShop.com. And then if you go to our followers, or if we follow on all of those pages, you can find me at Paco Asando. So that's PAAKOWESSANDOH.
Nice. And we'll link all of that below in the Forbes article that we've been referencing this whole time, because that's definitely a good read.
It's a really good one.
Yeah.
A really good one.
So.
Alrighty, so I think that brings us to the end.
Stay dope, stay blessed, and stay rooted, y'all.
Hey, there we go.
And so that is it from us, you guys. Thank you so much for tuning in for another episode of Afropolitan Central. But of course, we don't want the conversation to end here. We're so eager to hear from you guys and get your thoughts and your insight.
So you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook as Afropolitan Central. We'll leave all the links below. Make sure that you are subscribed and following us on wherever you listen to your podcast. We cannot wait to see you at the next episode.